Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to the 230th edition of Sudbury News Talk magazine. I'm Michelle Mandry, and I will be your presenter for the occasion, accompanied by a collection of regulars and introducing new contributor Richard Fawcett. I offered our team of contributors two topics this month. The first, advice, given or received, good or bad, and all stops in between. The second, favourite places. We start with a cautionary tale from Wayne Robinson.
The worst piece of advice I ever received was from a former manager of mine. It was late in 1987 and my girlfriend and I had just recently become engaged. Our plan was to save as much as we could for a house deposit to buy our home during 1988 and to get married in 1989 when we finished the necessary work on that house. At the time, the property market was getting very expensive. Comedians were even joking that their houses were earning more than they were each year. It seemed that we couldn't save fast enough to get on the ladder. We'd been looking at older properties rather than the tiny new homes that were being built everywhere. A solid Victorian terraced home in southeast London or northwest Kent would set us back about £48,000, but prices were rising by around £1,000 a month, and interest rates at the time were 14%. So the cost of buying was becoming ever more expensive, and it was pretty frustrating. Around Easter of 1988, we visited my fiancé's brother, who was stationed in the RAF in Norfolk. We happened to start talking about properties, and he told us that we could get a three-bedroom semi in a nearby town for under £30,000. Sandra and I discussed this over the next few days, and we formulated a plan. The idea was to make use of the ripple effect that we read about in the newspapers. The cities start the trend. London becomes oversubscribed with buyers, and so property prices rise. As they get too expensive, people start to move out, which fuels demand elsewhere, so prices outside start to rise too. It's like dropping a pebble into a pond and observing the way the water is displaced in ever-increasing circles, causing a ripple, hence the name. We thought about this and concluded that the ripples from the surge in prices had yet to reach Norfolk, and so if we purchased a house there, all we had to do was hang on to it for some months, perhaps give it a lick of paint, and then sell it in order to recoup our profit, thus giving us a larger deposit to buy our home that we needed in southeast London or northwest Kent. Genius! We were both very keen on this, but I decided to run the idea past my manager. After all, we both worked in financial services, and he was teaching and mentoring me in all things financial. As well as being my manager, Roy had become a good friend too. We got along very well and met socially outside of work with his wife Sue and Sandra, my fiance, becoming friends. We all had a great sense of humour and had a lot of fun when we met up, being silly and making each other laugh. All things considered, he was a good egg, and so we trusted him to give us a balanced opinion on our plan. He could immediately see the upside and why we thought it would be a great idea to buy now rather than later. But he also spoke about the potential downside, albeit in a more alarmist manner. What if the ripple effect stops? What if interest rates rise further, reducing housing demand? What if the legal costs and estate agents' costs eat away at your profit when you sell, making you worse off? What if the unoccupied property gets damaged in some way? Insurance is hard to get for such a building. What about interest rates on your savings? 10% wasn't to be scoffed at and was a guaranteed return rather than property values, which could fluctuate. And finally, can you honestly afford to take the risk? Giving due consideration to all these points, we decided against buying in Norfolk, so the idea was shelved and we continued to save as much as we could into the Build Society. By the autumn of 1988, we started looking at houses in our required areas. House price increases now meant that the £48,000 properties we previously looked at all those months ago had increased to £65,000. The increase that year had been fuelled largely by the abolition of the dual MIRAS tax relief that August, which unfairly gave unmarried partners each a chance to claim tax relief on the interest payable on the first £60,000 of the mortgage, whilst married couples only received joint tax relief on £30,000. Of course, simply announcing this change led to a rush of people queuing to buy, thus pushing prices up. As we intended to marry the following year, our double Myrus would cease anyway, so we didn't see the point in rushing. We eventually found the house we wanted and bought it for $65,000 with a 5% deposit and fees and insurances coming to a total of about £5,000 that we had to take from our savings. About the same time, we looked at property prices in Norfolk again. The type we'd thought about buying was now selling for around £55,000. Had we stuck to our plan, we could have had a further £20,000-ish to use after selling costs to put towards a bigger house or to reduce the mortgage we had, thus having a positive impact on our lifestyle. Some years later, I asked Roy why he talked me out of the plan. His answer was that he feared we'd move away and he'd lose a good employee. So much for his advice. The best advice I was ever given, which was after this and not by Roy, was trust your instincts.
Well, thank you, Wayne, for your hard-won wisdom. Instinct can be a powerful advisor if we can stop self-doubt getting in the way. Our next contributor takes us away from it all with a refreshing blast of ozone. Here's Toby Jacobs.
I've called this piece a marine drive. As one gets older, it is easy to lose sight of the past. Sometimes, all it takes is a certain something to bring the memories flooding back. For me, a sunny day and the sound of a gull in the sky can transport me back to a childhood day out that I can almost reach out and touch. This was one such day. When Mum and Dad announced that we were going to the coast the next day, weather permitting, I went to bed praying that rain wouldn't stop play. As I opened my morning eyes to an azure sky, I knew then that we were off to the beach. There was nothing more joyous than to see the car filling up with all the necessary accoutrements needed for a day at the seaside. It certainly made a change from taking bags of rubbish to the local tip. Items such as the icebox, sun loungers, and Lilo only ever saw the light of day on these special occasions. Luckily, we lived quite close to the motorway, and as we set off, our journey would hopefully be no more than an hour. As I pressed my face to the window ever harder, the moment came that I had patiently been waiting for. "Welcome to Brighton," the stone pillar said, although we were actually bound for its neighbour of Hove. As we ascended the last of the South Downs, the view opened up before us. A shimmering horizon, a liquid dream, the sea. There is something unique about the gardens that you find along the seafront, wherever you go. The gardeners at Hove Borough Council always did themselves proud. It's hard to believe that once upon a time, you could pull up on the front for the day without any ticket or permit. As we parked the car, the trimmed lawns and bountiful bedding plants were another indication that we were far from home. This was further compounded by the large mansion blocks that line the marine esplanade. There is a certain type of architecture that you only see at the coast, and it all added to the feeling of a special day to come. We unpacked the car and made our way to the beach by way of the West End Cafe. This was a small complex consisting of toilets, ice creams, and teas that we always aimed for. As we walked onto the promenade, my first sight of the pebbles and the crashing waves almost took my breath away. From Brighton in the east to Shoreham in the west, the sky met the water in an aquatic embrace of blueness. There was usually a welcoming sea breeze, accompanied by the tangible smell of ozone. Once we had claimed our little piece of heaven, there was only one thing left to do: swim. Unless you had flip-flops on, this involved doing a peculiar kind of dance down to the water's edge, as the stones did their best to impale themselves into your feet. As I slowly immersed myself into the frigid water, I felt my diaphragm start to tighten, and the higher up the water rose, the tighter it got. It must have reached some kind of sweet spot, for I let out a falsetto scream of piercing proportions. Barry Gibb, eat your heart out. Note, it's a little known fact that the Bee Gees wrote most of the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack whilst bathing in the sea at Bognor. Once my body had acclimatized itself to the bracing temperature, I started to feel a rather pleasing euphoria, an inner peace which seemed to take hold as I gazed skywards. This was long before the virtues of wild swimming were commonplace. To my left was the decaying remains of the West Pier, destroyed by fire some years earlier. Complete with its original signage, it looked slightly creepy, rather like the circus had left town in a hurry. Marooned on an island of cast iron, it was home to all manner of bird life, where once there had been laughter. With my valuable extremities threatening to stiffen up and drop off, I made for shore, and so followed a repertoire of dipping and drying, snoozing and frying. During the day, we sometimes ventured off for a walk along the front. This part of the coast was more traditional, and there were no amusements to speak of, except a boating lake and tennis courts. My parents always loved hiring one out for an hour or so. There was something delicious about the combination of hot asphalt and a cooling breeze. The promenade also had a selection of very basic beach huts. The occupants always looked very pleased with themselves as their miniature worlds were opened up for all to see. Nothing pleases the English more than tea and cake, and if you can combine that with a sea view, then you are a richer man than I. Another thing that seemed to be improved by the location was fish and chips. It simply tasted better by the sea. Fact. Why this is, no one knows. As we made our way back to our corner of beach, the sun started to drop, and a slight chill became evident in the air. The shadows grew longer, and slowly people began to leave in dribs and drabs. I always felt a pang of melancholy at the end of the day. Thoughts of returning home filled my mind. As we too started to pack up, I had one last look out to sea. I wanted to drink in as much of this natural elixir as I could. Drowsy from the day's exertions, I rested my head on the car window as we headed back to South London. Past the Devil's Dyke and the Jack and Jill windmills, our indicators of arrival were now those of departure. One final glimpse of the horizon and it was gone, until the next time at least. The ghostly remains of the West Pier finally crumbled into the sea, and the West End Cafe served its last cup of tea. However, it will always be so in my memory. Dad, are we there yet?
Thank you, Toby. Aren't seaside memories lovely to be able to return to and enjoy once more? I hope the sea breeze has swept away the cobwebs and sharpened your mind. Here's John Chambers with the quiz.
Nearly July already, halfway through another year, and the longest day, 21st of June, already behind us. Just to keep your marbles in good order, here are a few questions to tease your brains. Question 1. What are the sides of a stage called? And number two, in which month is St. George's Day? Question three, King Charles III was crowned with which crown? Four, that crown was borrowed for the day from where? And five, what is the crown called he wore after the ceremony? Question six, how many legs does a spider have? And number seven, who played Jean, wife of Lionel, in As Time Goes By? Question eight, what is sold at London's Billingsgate Market? Number nine, which gas puts the bubbles in fizzy drinks? And last, number 10. The River Forth flows into which sea? There. Off you go, make a cuppa, but hurry back for the next segment. And now back to Michelle.
Thank you, John. I really should have been taking notes while watching the coronation. More from John later with the answers. Next, we turn to Julie Thompson as she mulls over which of many could be her favourite place of all.
The longer you live, the more places you will have had the opportunity to live in, work in, or visit. And as I've managed half a century, I've experienced my fair share. I was thinking I could rattle on about all the places I've lived, but to be honest, there are eight of them, and they're all within 20 miles of Sudbury. So they're hardly going to wow you. Then I thought about the places I've visited in the UK and abroad for work or holidays. And since I met my now husband back in 2006, I've certainly racked up a number of holidays. In fact, I can tell you how many. Can you guess? It's been 17 years, and in that time, I've been away over 100 times. What a lucky lady I am. Now, I won't bore you with tales of them all, but I do like to drop into conversation at dinner parties that my husband and I climbed Kilimanjaro and that I've worked in India twice. But that's my bragging bit over and done with. We were both avid travellers, getting away every couple of months. But having been trapped in Italy during the 2010 volcanic ash incident, and again 10 years later in New Zealand when the COVID pandemic shut the world down, we've got out of the routine of regular travel. Until now, when we've booked a trip to Canada. Now, you would have thought we would be really excited about the trip. We're flying out with British Airways and going to visit an old school friend of my husband who lives in Alberta. It's our third time staying with him, and for reasons I won't go into, we're going there as it's unlikely he will make the journey back to Blighty anytime soon. We have 10 days with him and his wife, then a flight across the huge expanse to Toronto for a 5-day break on our own before flying back to the UK. Organising the trip has been fraught with challenges, including forgetting to request the online visa until yesterday, and then almost falling for one of those online scams that try to charge you $99 for something you can get for $7 if you find the official website. It turns out that once you get to a certain age, not me, the travel insurance costs triple, so that was a shock. And then the cost of parking your car at one of London's airports costs more than our internal flights across the second largest country in the world. Yesterday, the sun was shining. We spent the day at our home, reading the newspaper in bed with a pot of tea, pottering round the house and tidying up the garden to a soundtrack of Mr. Blackbird. Not very exciting, I know. But we enjoyed it, and as the weather's brightened up, my motivated DIYer has a number of projects lined up that he can't wait to crack on with. So over dinner last night, it turns out we were both thinking the same thing. Why on earth have we decided to go away on holiday when home is our favourite place?
Thank you, Julie. I think you may have hit the nail on the head. I often long for the comfort of my own bed when I've been away. And now for something completely different. Our guest for this edition brings us news of life on Sudbury Common Lands. Here's Adrian Walters.
Hello, Adrian here from the Sudbury Common Lands Charity. Although I retired as ranger 3 years ago, I still work for the charity, and I'm providing you with this little update. Too much reading can be bad for me, particularly as I read many ecologically related books and articles. For example, Dave Goulson's Silent Earth really brings home the globally wide-ranging negative effects that we have on our wildlife. Fortunately, the antidote to this gloom is not too far away in the form of our wonderful riverside and other areas managed by the Sudbury Common Lands Charity. Yes, of course, they are influenced to a great extent by factors that are way beyond our control. But it is the little things that can reduce stress and bring us joy. After what seemed to have been a long winter, the speed with which spring unfolded was nothing short of a miracle. Of course, this year we had plenty of rain, so the run of five dry springs was finally broken. This ensured that our lovely marsh orchids were not consigned to total oblivion, although numbers are still precariously low. The orchid walks of 10 years ago to view almost 3,000 colourful pink and mauve blooms might never return, but a few spikes in the Friars Meadow wildflower area this spring were still lovely to see, and to my great surprise, we also had 4 very rare hybrid marsh orchids, which was truly wonderful. A few yards away at Ladies Island, water voles sit on the riverbanks chewing stems of vegetation. Again, numbers are much reduced, but there was a time between 1996 and 2012 when there were no water voles at all in Sudbury because of predation by North American mink. Familiar ratty had simply disappeared. Happily, mink, which are a scourge of our native aquatic wildlife, have been eradicated throughout East Anglia, and the idea is now to try and eradicate them from the British Isles. That is certainly a very ambitious goal, but if we don't try, they may return. They ought to have been dealt with from the 1960s and included in the concerted effort to eradicate that very large South American rodent, the coypew. In England, the last 2 coypews were said to have been run over in 1989. However, there is a story that one old coypew lived out his final days in peace near Baker's Mill in Great Cornard. Another unwelcome guest from the southern United States of America and Mexico is the red-eared terrapin, known in its native lands as the red-eared slider. These live in the Ladies Island backwater adjacent to Friars Meadow and were dumped there as they outgrew the teenage mutant ninja turtle craze of the 1980s and 90s. Now, several of Leonardo and Donatello's compatriots are becoming the size of dinner plates. Terrapins, like their cousins, the tortoises, can live for quite a long time. And as they have no natural predators here, they may still be about for another 10 or 20 years, gobbling up our native wildlife. At present, our climate is not warm enough for their eggs to hatch successfully. So let's hope that they come to the natural end of their lives, like the Cornard coypew, before things warm up too much. Over in Great Cornard Country Park, management that was put in place over a decade ago is bearing bountiful fruit. Wide margins to the mown open spaces were left to grow with naturally occurring native grasses and shrubs to provide a diverse habitat for lizards and slowworms, which are still frequent there. However, one of the unforeseen but happy consequences of this policy is that nightingales can be heard once again in our locality. These small brown birds are very shy and skulk about in the undergrowth, but their song gives everything away. While I am very pleased to hear them, for me, I still find the familiar fluting notes of the blackbird hard to beat. Of course, there is the black cap, which also has a beautiful song. But when the nightingale gets going, it has an extraordinary variety of gurgles, staccatos and whistles, creating a very rich variety of sounds. In May, I received a concerning email about the lack of kingfishers in the Stour Valley. Many people who keep an eye out for these colourful little birds had not seen one, which seemed rather odd. Although the winter was chillier than of recent years, it should not have affected the kingfishers in any way, because the ditches and river did not freeze over. Fortunately, when the email came through, we had confirmed reports of nesting on the Sudbury Riverside, although high water levels from the spring rains may have washed out their first attempt. Hopefully, further nesting through the summer should provide plenty of juvenile birds. Vast quantities of summer rain is not what we require, as this would put further pressure on them. Indeed, back in 2012, their attempts to raise young were scuppered both in May and July as the meadows flooded twice. This was very unusual because traditionally the summer cattle grazing season avoids the normal flooding periods. However, even in adverse conditions, there is always a silver lining, because during that miserable summer, skylarks nested one more time on the Sudbury Common lands because of a significant reduction in people and their dogs, something which we are unlikely to witness again. Well, that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoyed this little roundup of the wildlife on our riverside. Bye for now.
Thank you, Adrian. It's very encouraging to hear that with thought, land management can have beneficial outcomes for wildlife. Back on the theme of advice, Ken Watkins has some sage words courtesy of his mother-in-law.
My mother-in-law, who spent her early years in Scotland after her father moved from Eastbourne to Dundee soon after the First World War to set up a photographic business, never really forgot that time and was always coming out with Scottish sayings that she insisted were good advice. I followed some of them, occasionally deliberately, occasionally because that's the way life worked out, and much as it might once have pained me to admit it, she was often right. Nora died some 20 years ago, but I swear since then I've heard her say, "Told you so." One saying was, "Money a mickle, max a muckle," which threw me the first time I heard it more than 50 years ago, before she patiently explained. My mum Alice had always said the same thing, simply using different words. "Take care of the pennies and the pounds will take care of themselves." Mind you, these days, offering the advice to take care of the pennies to anyone who hasn't yet reached middle age would probably be met with a blank look as they wondered what on earth a penny was. I occasionally see one now, on the all too rare occasions I use cash, although they're no longer the large penny coin of my youth, just a tiny coin known dismissively as 1p. But both Alice and Laura were right. Both had grown up during the First World War. Both had experienced the Depression of the 30s, the Second World War, and the austerity that followed, and both knew the value of saving if and when you could afford it. So we tried, not always successfully, to follow that advice. It got slightly easier when our children left home and Judy and I were a little more able to siphon some funds into the bank of Mum and Dad. Another piece of Scottish advice from my mother-in-law was, "Never sit on a prickle," a pithy and concise way of saying, if you're unhappy with the situation and can change it, do so. Don't stick around feeling miserable. It was certainly advice that she and my father-in-law followed throughout their marriage, as they moved house at least 9 times for various reasons, mainly in South Wales, where Harold, my father-in-law, had been born. They eventually settled in Barry, which is where my wife was living when we first met at university in North Wales. But in retirement, my in-laws moved once again, back to Eastbourne, completing the circle. So my wife was accustomed to moving, which was a blessing, really. As for various reasons, my career as a journalist took me to different parts of England and Wales. We enjoyed 35 years in Suffolk, most of them when I worked at the Free Press in Sudbury, before we completed our own circle by moving to Barry during the COVID pandemic. My parents were completely different. They lived in Coventry all their lives, moving just once in 55 years of marriage to a different part of the city. My dad, George, had two pieces of advice, which I've often considered, even if not always followed. One was to call a spade, which is fine sometimes. But when you work on a local paper, diplomacy rather than bluntness tends to get better results if you're dealing with a controversial story. However, if a situation these days calls for a bit of blunt speaking, then I'm not afraid to air my opinion. But to be honest, that usually means shouting at the radio or television if something's been said I totally disagree with. Dad's other piece of advice was never regret what's happened if you can't change it. Conversely, of course, he said, if you regret something and are in a position to change it for the better, then do so. Not so far away from don't sit on a prickle. Of course, the first part is easier said than done. Inevitably, there are always likely to be events in our past which we occasionally look back on and think, what if? That's life. But while thinking, if only I'd done something different 10, 20, 34 years ago, maybe entertaining, frustrating, or both, I know it's really a pointless exercise. Not that that has ever stopped me.
Thank you, Ken. Good advice from your dad there too. My dad shared his knowledge freely but rarely gave advice. The only piece I remember was look after your nose. From the son, of course. Well, he wasn't wrong. Back to John Chambers now with the answers to the quiz he stumped us all with earlier.
Here we go, and the answers start with a bonus question. Is Flaming June living up to expectations? Yes? Good. Now let's get to something we can control. The answer to question one. The sides of a stage are called the wings. And number two. Now this is a test for those of you who are listening to my last quiz. St. George's Day is the 23rd of April. Answer three. Mine's back to early May. And almost a couple of months ago, King Charles was crowned with the St. Edward's crown. And this has been so since 1660. That was the year the monarchy was restored and worn by Charles II. The answer to the next question, four, is it was borrowed for the day from the Tower of London, where it's kept along with a lot of other regalia, guarded by beefeaters and ravens, but not vegetarians and ravens, although they may be vegetarian beefeaters. Answer 5. Again, by tradition, since the 1660s, it was quickly exchanged for the imperial state crown, which he wore for a long time after leaving Westminster Abbey. Neither looked comfortable, and he was not seen for a few days afterward, as he was reportedly had an aching neck. Answer 6 was a quick count of the number of spiders' legs. 8 was the answer, because a spider is an arachnid and not an insect, who are blessed with 6 legs. Another arachnid is the scorpion. Ugh. As time goes by, as seen on TV in the 1980s, with Dame Judi Dench playing Jean Pargiter, until she married on the screen Lionel, played by Geoffrey Palmer. They were a great team and the script was wonderfully put together. That was number 7. Number 8. Billingsgate Market sells fish. When I worked in the City of London in the 70s, my office being next to Wren's Monument to the Great Fire of London, with Billingsgate just down the hill on the bank of the Thames. The cobbles around were littered with ice and slush, and by 8:30 in the morning, the pubs were open, for the fish porters who, coming off all night shift, 6 nights a week, needed a pint. I was tempted out of inquisitiveness to join them, but managed to stay focused on my day ahead. On reflection, I should have just gone and done it. Just for your edification only, the building I was in backed onto Pudding Lane, and some of you may well be aware the Great Fire is said to have started in the then bakery shop. Don't think fried fish from Billingsgate was popular in 1666. Carbon dioxide is the culprit for the bubbles in many fizzy drinks. And finally, the Firth of Forth deposits into the North Sea, east of Edinburgh. And finally, in my search for silly signs, this one amused. Seen in a hotel. A sports jacket may be worn to dinner, but no trousers. And how about this for instant pain, ear-piercing while you wait? And that, dear listeners, is it until September. Enjoy what follows. Goodbye, and back to Michelle.
Ah, thank you, John. If only we could all borrow a crown from the tower, wouldn't the country be a much more glamorous sight? Making his Sudbury News Talk magazine debut, our last article on advice comes from new contributor Richard Fawcett with his advice on advice.
Good old Grandad always knows, and poor old Grandma never has a clue until suddenly she does, and Grandad's in a tizzy. Too late. Should have listened to Grandma this time, and maybe other times too. Maybe Grandad just told you what you wanted to hear. Slippery ground giving and taking advice. For instance, your neighbours and the fabulous restaurant they've discovered. Lovely food, lovely people. Bit pricey, perhaps, but you have a birthday soon and you mull the idea over. You'd been thinking of somewhere more modest, but you've had a little lottery win. Fast forward to midnight on the M11. The car's broken down on the way home after your meal, which cost an arm and a leg, plus other body parts, including your stomach, where food poisoning is beginning to gurgle. Do you want to A, kick yourself for listening to your neighbours, or B, just kick your neighbours? Suing them won't get you far, and if you do kick them, they'll likely just dial 999. And if you hadn't noticed, we haven't yet established whether you're particularly friendly with them. So why take their advice? Just keeping up with the Joneses, perhaps? Oh, by the way, best not to kick your solicitor when she or he refuses to touch your case with a barge pole, but medical and legal advice are not our concern here. We'll focus on everyday advice between friends, family, even strangers, oh, and of course, enemies. Things are already slippery enough without involving lawyers. Another, for instance, someone says, oh, you do look poorly, you really should. Is this genuine concern for your well-being, meaning you really should rest, or a devious relative gaslighting you, meaning you need help, you're not coping, dearest? And please bear with me here, there's been gaslighting in the Archers, so this is realism. And how about this? I didn't mean you should actually do it. I was just thinking out loud. Or, well, it's none of my business, I know, but don't you think you should? Or even, if you want my advice, or alternatively, if you want my advice. And so responsibility slides easily from the advisor to the advised. Oh, it's slippery, all right. Although advice can be more blunt than slippery, I'm thinking of someone older who simply assumes they know better than someone younger, and in particular of a parent knowing better than their child what is best for the child. It's for your own good. Well, better than a child of two, yes. Of 12, quite likely, though you should have met mine at age 12. But a child of 16, 17, or of age at 18, that's not so clear to me. Each on its merits, please. Wisdom doesn't always come with age, and the young are not invariably devoid of it. Cards on the table, I am in my 70s. Here's a snippet from Shakespeare, often quoted as the final word on virtuous thrift, and rather ironic in the mouths of people with mortgages. neither a borrower nor a lender be. Polonius, the speaker, is a counsellor at the Danish court, and a counsellor with C-I must surely be a good counsellor with S-E. He's also a parent. So would you take advice from Polonius, the kind of man to be paid attention to, bearing in mind that he's also referred to as a wretched, rash, intruding fool? Neither a borrower nor a lender be is only one of numerous moralisings rattled off by Polonius to his son Laertes as the young man leaves for France. Laertes has just browbeaten his sister Ophelia over her closeness to Prince Hamlet and her need to safeguard her reputation. Be wary then, best safety lies in fear. She has spirit enough to caution him to follow his own advice, but crumbles when her father, Polonius, quizzes her about young Hamlet. He belittles her and forbids her to speak to the prince, for which silence he later chides her. Not yet finished with his son Laertes, he sets a spy on him in France. Oh, doubtless in case the moralizing wears off. So, how does this all end? Badly. With insanity, suicide, poisonings, etc., in spite of all that advice. Now, the play Hamlet is hardly the everyday I mentioned. However, I submit that overhearing these characters on stage, you end up knowing more about them than about some of the people whose advice you might act on in the everyday. So, before taking advice, I suggest that you always think at least twice. That's my advice, anyway, for what it's worth. But how much is it worth? Do you know? Eh? Because I haven't got a clue.
Thank you very much, Richard. An entertaining first outing, and with much to ponder on there, I think. Our final contributor for this edition is Ruth Salisbury Higgs, who, like Julie Thompson, also has a hard task in settling on her favourite place.
Hello, dear listeners. When Michelle asked us to think about our favourite places, several wonderful memories came to mind. Oh, how I love a beach. I could sit for hours, and very often do, just watching the ocean crash to the shore. My husband and I have visited some beautiful beaches in the UK, in particular Broadhaven Beach, which is situated along a dramatic stretch of the Pembrokeshire coastline in Wales. Just a short 10-minute drive from where our friends live in Haverford West, this stunning beach with a huge expanse of sand gives me a sense of tranquility as soon as I see it appearing over the horizon as we drive towards it. As you step onto the beach, to the left-hand side is a huge rock formation that looks like a majestic lion roaring out to sea. It's a safe beach for families, and as we've mostly only ever visited in the winter or spring, I've been fortunate enough never to see it too overcrowded. Generally, there is the odd windsurfer or landsurfer making the most of the winds, and the children playing in the many rock pools that are teeming with life. If the tide is far enough out, we walk from Broadhaven around the headland to Littlehaven, where a great little pub called the Swan is to be found. We normally get ourselves a couple of beers and then sit on the wall outside watching the world go by. We were there just before Christmas last year, and outside the neighbouring pub was a really cute Christmas tree made of lobster pots. Another favourite spot that we've only been lucky enough to visit the once is the Isle of Skye in Scotland. Oh my goodness, it's well worth the drive. We first drove to Edinburgh in 2016 to watch the English rugby team play Scotland at Murrayfield. Well, the trip got off to a good start as England won. Sorry to any of our Scottish listeners, but it is safe to say you've made up for it in recent years. Edinburgh, the city built on and of granite, is a fascinating city to visit, with so many nooks and crannies, and much to my husband's delight, more choice in whiskies than you can shake a whiskey tumbler at. A shopping trip along the Royal Mile was a must, just to wonder at the many array of tartan goods. Plus, another must-do walk was around the outskirts of Edinburgh Castle. We stood and looked at the spot where the famous tattoo happens and imagined the noise of the military bands and many horses. From Edinburgh, we drove to the Isle of Skye, and the coastline there just took my breath away. It wasn't a holiday to sit on the beach. For a start, it was February, not Scotland's warmest month. And secondly, there is just so much fascinating scenery to explore. One of the standout moments for me was a trip to the beautifully clear, crystal blue waters at Carbost called the Fairy Pools. These three stunning pools of water lie at the foot of the Black Coolin Hills and are fed by roaring waterfalls from above. It's one of the biggest tourist attractions on the Isle of Skye, but when we were there, the weather had taken a bad turn for the worst, so the pools, although stunning, didn't look all that crystal clear. Despite a howling gale and pouring rain, some crazy folk were actually swimming in the freezing water. Well, I say swimming, they jumped in, screamed very loudly, and scrambled back out again. The winds were so strong at one point, I thought I was actually going to be blown off my feet into the pools. I dug both my walking poles deeply down into the ground, put my head down, and my husband stood in front of me until the severe gusts had passed by. It was a bit of a scary moment, but also very exhilarating. While on the Isle of Skye, we took many trips. One to the remotest pub in the UK, which was owned at that time by a very unfriendly Belgian chap. The pub is called The Forge and is situated on the Nooit Dart Peninsula. The only way to reach it is a 2-day hike or a 7-mile sea crossing. We opted for the latter, and although this fantastic little pub sits in a really spectacular setting, the attitude of the owner spoilt the moment a little for us. It has subsequently been bought by the community, so it's probably worth another visit. On the trip home, we hadn't been driving very long when we saw a signpost to a beach called Silver Sands, so we detoured to see if it really was silver. Well, I have to say, you would have thought you'd landed in the Caribbean. The sun was shining, albeit with very little warmth, but the water was a crystal blue and the beach was made of a brilliant fine white sand. We knew we had a long drive home, so stayed just for a short walk, but the memory of that hidden little gem stayed with us as it was such an unexpected find. Now, I may have mentioned once or twice that my son, daughter-in-law and our precious little grandson live in Australia. I haven't even started on all my favourite beaches there, where the sky is the biggest I've ever seen. And if you are there at the right time of year, you may be lucky enough to witness the whales breaching as they make their way up the coast to birth their calves. But that's a story for another day, perhaps.
Thank you, Ruth. You do paint a vivid picture, and we look forward to hearing about your favourite places in Australia another time. Thank you to all of my contributors for their words on advice and excursions to all the best places. I hope you've enjoyed this edition of the magazine, and I'd like to leave you with a quote that does not include present company, but is from François de la Rochefoucauld, and I rather enjoy it. He said, "Good advice is something a man gives when he is too old to set a bad example." Until next time, goodbye.